service.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. Janis Joplin died at the age of 27, and she lived a life that, much like her worn-down voice, was both ragged and passionate. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 5 would be the number of times she'd sometimes repeat a phrase in a song, and the repetition of a device of anticipation that would lead to cathartic release, something like, "Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, and cry, baby." 1 more would be the number of Hell's Angels chapters that would turn on Janis, never mind her years of solidarity and friendship, when she didn't play by their rules. Another 12 would be the number of hours it took her to recover from a transcontinental train trip across the prairies of Canada, where she continued to evolve as an artist, as an amalgamation of musical influences. Another 1 would be the number of love-struck record producers she convinced to work with her, despite the fact that her continued addiction and increasingly erratic behavior was indicative of darker days ahead. And 8 would be the number of weeks she'd have left to live after she showed up late to a gig at the Harvard Stadium on August 12, 1970, and played the last set she'd ever play in front of an audience. On this, our 10th episode of Season 3, Cathartic Release, Love-Struck Producers, Vindictive Hell's Angels, and Janis Joplin, Walking a Winding Path to Liberation. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Garnett Mims heard all the rumors about Burt Burns. He heard that Burt Burns had friends deep in the New York Mafia, and not just some hot air music executive types, the real deal, the Genovese family kind of friends. He heard that Burt Burns threatened Van Morrison. He heard that Burt Burns orchestrated some mafioso smoke bomb scare at a Neil Diamond show in the Village. He heard that Burt Burns didn't give a fuck. He heard that the guy was a walking time bomb, and not just in the sense that he had a temper and was often packing heat. His ticker was all fucked up, and at any moment, the thing could take its last talk. Garnett didn't know Burt Burns. He just heard all the stories that people told about him on the streets of Philly, secondhand stories passed down from the streets of New York City. Garnett felt more comfortable with Burns' songwriting partner, Jerry Ragavoy. In fact, he kind of knew Ragavoy since the two of them hailed from the city of brotherly love and all. And that was one of the things that Garnett and Ragavoy bonded over when Garnett moved his vocal group, The Enchanters, up 95 to the Big Apple. But no one called the guy Ragavoy. They all called him Rags. Everyone back in Philly called him that. Everyone at the electrical appliance shop where he worked, the one that had a section of choice 78s just for the hell of it. This was back in the 1950s, back in the day when a local singing group could bring their demo to the local appliance store. The one with the music section in the back, and the guys working there would be so impressed and so excited that they'd drop everything, and on the spot decide to start a record label from scratch just so they could release the group's debut single. That's exactly what Rags did when the Castells walked through the shop's front door, acetate in hand. Rags was no singer, not even a great player. But he loved blues music, doo-wop, rhythm, and blues. He had an ear for it. He had a heart for it. He loved the music so much that he started writing songs on his own, songs that were honest-to-God hits. He loved the music so much that he split the small-change town of Philly for the greener pastures of New York City. It was there that he wrote Time Is On My Side, a track that would later give the Rolling Stones their first top 10 hit in the U.S. Rags had this one particular song, though, that he could never finish. Couldn't shake it either. He tried to file it away in a drawer, but he'd find it months later, unfinished and gnawing at him. He'd forget about it on purpose. The thing was a time suck that seemed to exist solely to cast doubt on his own ability to do what he thought he was able to do. It was a reminder that he didn't always finish what he started, that he wasn't the best, that he wasn't prolific, that he'd wake up in the middle of the night, the half-finished chorus banging around in the back of his head, taunting him. And then he got Burt Burns involved. Burns was an assassin when it came to putting the finishing touches on a tune. Garnett Mims saw it with his own two eyes. He'd made the pilgrimage up to New York City when he'd been summoned to Burns' apartment. He was told to come alone, leave the enchanters behind. Burns was real hush-hush like that. Garnett walked in to find Burns and Rags tying together the frayed ends of Crybaby, the song that Rags had, until that moment, been unable to finish. The one he couldn't shake, the one that gnawed at him. Garnett felt like he'd walked into the meeting of some secret society, some sacred space where alchemy was happening. Burns would nod his head and Rags would put his pencil to the paper. Burns stood at the end of a piano and didn't say much. He didn't have to. He oozed all that tough guy menace that he picked up from the wise guys he hung around. He was letting Rags hold the reins. But Garnett picked up on the vibe that hung in the room. It was Burns' apartment, after all. Burns' piano. It was Burns' world, and the rest of them were just living in it. The unspoken truth was that Burt Burns could take control of everything with the snap of his connected fingers, if that's what he wanted. Garnett followed Rags' lead. He did what they wanted him to do, sang the song how they wanted him to sing it. He knew an opportunity when he saw one. He knew not to look the proverbial gift horse in the mouth, especially if said gift horse had some scarred-faced brass-knuckled bruisers on the inside. And the songwriting duo then told Garnett that he'd go to the recording session without the enchanters. Rags had some great singers already on tap to provide backup. Sissy Houston, along with her two nieces, Dion and Dee Dee Warwick. Garnett felt like he was being unfaithful to his Philly-bred bandmates. Rags told him not to worry about it. It was just business. Burns didn't say anything, but just gave Garnett that stare. That stare from the other side of the piano that encouraged him not to worry about it. When it was released on the United Artists label in August of 1963, Garnett Mims' Crybaby went to the top of the R&B chart, and then it went to number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100. Along with Peace of My Heart, Crybaby would be one of two Burt Burns' Jerry Ragavoy compositions that would make their way to Janis Joplin. Janis road tested her version of the song with the Full Tilt Boogie Band during the summer of 1970, including the brief but memorable Festival Express tour that took them, along with the Grateful Dead and others, across Canada. Janis' Crybaby was a showstopper, even if she played it at the beginning of the show. She branded the song as her own, dropping in extended riffs in the song's middle section about how her man ran off to Detroit or Kathmandu or Nepal. Garnett Mims' little song that could was now an impassioned cry that reached its arms out to the whole wide world. Janis felt she was ready to put it down on tape. In the studio with producer Paul Rothchild recording what would become her final album, Pearl, Janis gave a crybaby performance for the ages, larynx shredding, impassioned vocal and all. And people loved it. It made its way up the charts when it was released as a single in 1971. Problem was, by the time the world got to hear it 2 months later, Janis Joplin was dead. Like any Hell's Angels party, the concert that the San Rafael chapter of the Notorious Motorcycle Club was now hosting was rife with drama. Not just drama, but tension too. The tension in the place was so thick you could cut it with one of the knives the Angels kept on their belts. It was March 1970, and the infamous Rolling Stone show at the Altamont Speedway still hung around the rock and biker culture like a black cloud. In December of 69, the peace and love ethos of Woodstock was pummeled into the mud by security guards turned rogue nihilist thugs. The Hells Angels freaked the fuck out at Altamont, and the whole rock and roll world was still reeling from the fallout. Albert Grossman, for one, was skeptical about the whole thing. The fact that one of his most important clients, Janis Joplin, was headlining a show of support of one of the most dangerous and hated groups of people in the United States didn't make him feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Pretty fucking far from it, actually. And to make matters worse, the Angels were paying Janis a measly $260 for the honor to perform in front of them. $260, Janis Joplin, in 1970, at the height of her fame. Janis had asked Albert to bite his tongue, to allow her to do this one favor. And the Angels had been good to her in the past. They had accepted her as one of their own. And she was their little sister. They protected her. They looked out for her. The least she could do was play a show for them at a friendly rate. Plus, you had guys like Sweet William. Sweet William was the kind of angel that Janis liked. He had the badass angel look, long black hair, devilish goatee, but deep down he was a total softie. He was named after a flower, for Christ's sakes. He was the vice president of the San Francisco chapter of the Angels. Janis did shows like these for guys like Sweet William. Guys like Sweet William gave the club a good name. It wasn't just Hell's Angels in the room. The actor Michael J. Pollard was there too. Still reminiscing about the New York City party with Bob Newhart and Kris Kristofferson. Still glowing from his Oscar nomination a few years back. Now, however, instead of waxing nostalgic with stories of Faye Dunaway, he was holding court with tales about the recent shoot with Robert Redford on the set of Little Foss and Big Halsey. Janis slung her arm around Pollard's shoulder and pulled him close. She wanted to hear all about the bikes that Pollard and Redford rode for the flick. She wanted to hear about every single goose of the throttle, about every single breeze that blew through their hair, about every single open road they surveyed in the distance, each vista on each horizon, so distant and everlasting that it made a person ponder the meaning of it all. Janis loved that feeling, the feeling of discovering something new, the feeling of tooling down a highway long and flat and infinite, and hoping it would take you to a better place, a place where you could feel free, better yet, a place to be free. It was the same feeling she got when she sat in a passenger seat and made the trek from Texas to California, or Chicago to California, or the East Coast to the West Coast. She repeated those far-flung, free-flowing journeys so often just to harness that feeling again, the electric anticipation of freedom. But Robert Redford wasn't too shabby either. She listened to Pollard talk all about that handsome matinee idol all night long. And Janis kept a grip on Pollard's shoulder as she walked towards the stage, a bottle of half-empty Southern Comfort dangling from her hand. She was ready to give the Restless Angels crowd what they wanted, but it quickly became clear that they wanted more than music. They wanted control, even if it meant they had to create chaos first. As Janis and Pollard approached the stage, one of the Angels lunged for Janis's bottle of Southern Comfort. "Give me a swig of that sweet stuff, Janis," the Angel yelled. A group of bikers sitting next to him erupted into laughter. Then Janis took her arm off Pollard and steadied the bottle. She'd played this game before. She was always ready to play it again. "Fuck off, boys. This is my bottle," she responded. "Get your own liquor." And the Angel stood up from his seat, and the laughter quickly subsided. She didn't recognize anyone in this particular subsection of MC members. Sure as hell wasn't Sweet William. "I'm thirsty," the Angel said, his voice full of impatience. "And you are playing for us. If I want some of your goddamn Southern Comfort, I'll take some of your goddamn Southern Comfort." A few tables away, Albert Grossman was getting nervous. He ran his hand through his shoulder-length white hair and scanned the room for allies. He'd watched shit go pear-shaped before. He knew the drill. Janis stood her ground and kept the bottle as far from the Angel as she could. She looked him dead in the eye, raised her arm, and pointed her finger in his direction. "Fuck you, man," she yelled. "Fuck all of you." And then, the chaos came. One of the biker's girlfriends jumped out of a nearby cluster of angels, glass pint of beer in her hand. She ran straight for Janis, who didn't even see her coming. Suddenly, the entire pint of beer was airborne. It had left the glass and made a swan dive trajectory right for Janice's face. The girlfriend tossed the empty glass on the floor. It shattered into pieces at their feet. And Grossman was on his feet now. Pollard backed away. "Fucking Hell's Angels," Grossman was muttering under his breath. He kept watch to see what would happen next. "Do you know who you're talking to?" the girlfriend was screaming at Janis. "You can't talk like that to a Hell's Angel." Janis wiped the sticky beer from her face and flung the excess at the girlfriend. "Yeah, well," Janis responded, "fuck you too." The girlfriend then leapt in the air and tackled Janis to the floor. The two rolled around, kicking and screaming, the wet beer mopped up by the feathers in Janis's hair and the shards of glass digging into their backs. When the girlfriend took her hands to Janice's face and started to dig, she grabbed one of Janice's ears and pulled out her earring in a violent tug. And the blood sprang out from Janice's ear all over the girlfriend's hand and then mixed in with the discarded pint on the hardwood. Janice was throwing punches and screaming. She connected a few times with the enraged biker girlfriend who was on top of her now. Janice's eyes were shut tight, and she just yelled and kicked and threw punches. The whole place went bananas. Grossman struggled to get close to the action to help Janice. He just kept replaying the moment from the Altamont show when that Hell's Angels fatally stabbed Meredith Hunter. He was terrified that the same scene was about to play out in front of him, that the chaos was so overpowering so it was impossible to get through. He felt powerless. Before long, the girlfriend's angel had pulled her off Janice, and he took her place. He straddled on top of her, held her down with his left hand, and pulled his right hand back. He wound up, he was ready to clock Janice Joplin in her smug fucking mug. This old lady was right, man. How dare she talk to the MC that way? He wound his fist up tight in the air. Janice opened her eyes, and the crowd around them was panicking. The boys from the San Rafael chapter were holding back others who wanted to pull Janice to safety. Janice's eyes darted around. She had lost track of Pollard. She called out for Grossman. And the angel clenched his raised fist tighter, so tight that he felt his long, dirty fingernails dig into the meat of his palm. He gritted his teeth, gritted them so tight he thought something would snap. And just as he began to bring his fist down toward Janice's face, Sweet William intervened. He jumped over a nearby table, took a few big strides, and brought his foot straight into the angel's face. As Sweet William pulled Janice out of the fray and kept those who wanted more blood at bay, Janice was no longer thinking about the promises of freedom on a long open road. She was thinking of a darkness on the horizon. She thought of a darkness hanging over an entire scene that she had once loved. She thought of the diminishing returns of the life of a rock singer. She thought about how glad she was in that chaotic moment to be alive and wondered how much longer she would be able to hold on to that feeling.
We'll be right back after this word.
The kid with the off-white khakis and horn-rimmed glasses on the opposite side of the fence got Bobby Davis's attention the old school way. Psst. Bobby took notice of the kid out of the corner of his eye. Wave of hair cresting over his left eye, intermittent week-old stubble dotting his chin. Kid's hands hung off the chain link in the most casual of ways. Bobby D. That was the first way to Bobby's heart, referring to him in the shorthand in a way that communicated intimacy. Bobby looked to his left and then to his right, checking to see if the coast was clear. He wasn't 100% ready to abandon his post just because this kid happened to know his name. Psst, Kate called again. Grass is greener on this side of the fence, my man, he whispered, and this time, he dangled a tightly wound joint between two fingers. He had pushed it halfway through the fence. This was the second way to Bobby's heart, and most definitely constituted a free pass. Bobby looked around again, made sure he didn't see any faculty or staff, and then slowly eased his way to the fence doobie. Outside the fence, the crowds were quickly growing and the queue to enter the Harvard Stadium was becoming longer and less orderly. It was dusk and concertgoers were arriving at a steady clip now. It wasn't Bobby's job to watch the steady clip of paying customers. He was hired by the Schaefer Music Festival to watch for any deadbeat who decided to forego the $2 ticket price and tried to hop the chain link fence. And the fence jumpers were always easy to spot. Always. They'd linger on the outskirts of the slow-moving queue, pretending a little too hard to look like they actually belonged there, little fuckers. They always had a nervous look in their eye. The tiniest noise or smallest movement would make their eyes dart this way or that. And they'd nervously wait for the right time to bail. They'd think that Bobby or the other college kids hired as gatecrasher narcs weren't looking, and suddenly they'd make a run for it. And they're always faster in their heads than in reality. Bobby got better at the job as the summer concert season wore on. By August, it was a cakewalk. He'd beat El Cheapo to the fence half the time, right after he read the jumper's face and watched the wheels turn in his head. Bobby's sneakers would be pounding the pavement a full second before the would-be freerider put his hands on the chain link. The smartest gatecrashers were the ones who knew how to buy off Bobby. A term of endearment and some mellow grass. It was that easy. Bobby was easy to find, wearing his assigned red t-shirt with the white peace sign on the front. Anyone with half a brain cell knew the gatecrasher narcs buy those shirts. and jumping the fence could lead to getting hurt or worse, getting arrested, and slipping a doob into Bobby's hand bypassed all the unnecessary chaos. Bobby took the joint from the kid's hand and then gave him the silent nod, the silent nod, the one that indicated that the kid had 5 seconds to make it over the fence while Bobby turned his back. You had 5 seconds, flat, and after that, Bobby couldn't help you anymore. Bobby folded his arms across his chest to cover up the peace sign that broadcast the fact that he worked for the Schaefer Festival, that he worked for Harvard Stadium. He listened to the fence rattle awkwardly as the kid made his way up and over, another desperate pilgrim off on a free ride. He pocketed the joint for later that night. It was hot that day, August 12, 1970. Summer in Cambridge, Massachusetts wasn't without its stretches of oppressively muggy days. As Bobby's uncle said back home, it was hotter than a slapped ass, but this was Harvard, this was respectable territory, so Bobby had to keep the randy jokes to himself until he got back to the Emerson campus across the river later in the evening. He could hear his mother in his head, "Know your audience." Probably the best thing about being a gatecrasher narc was that he got to be part of the audience on every concert night. This summer had been chock full of great shows. Dylan and the Band, Ray Charles, The Grateful Dead, 10 years after. Tonight's $2 headliner was none other than Janis Joplin. Janis and her Full Tilt Boogie Band had just returned from their allotted Festival Express tour of Canada, and they were in tip-top shit hot shape. On board that train, they picked up blistering blues licks from Buddy Guy, hound dog hollers from Rick Danko, nuggets of Americana from Jerry Garcia, and white-hot R&B cues from Delaney and Bonnie. Word on the street was that this was the best incarnation of the foot-stomping, hoot-and-hollering Janis. And they were tighter than Big Brother and the Holding Company, and more withered than the Cosmic Blues Band. They chug-a-lugged with the combined forces of their musical inspirations, past and present. And but the smart kid crowd at the Harvard Stadium would have to wait a little longer for the show to begin. An unseen, unknown delay was preventing the show from starting on time. Sadly, show delays were becoming an all-too-regular occurrence in the rock and roll world. And like all other show delays at other recent concerts across the U.S., the crowd was less than pleased. Typically, when a show started, Bobby would pull a plain red t-shirt from where it was stashed in the back pocket of his jeans and pull it over the Gate Narc peace sign shirt. He'd make his way into the crowd and relieve himself from his shift on his own recognizance. But tonight, the crowd of nearly 33,000 were growing increasingly impatient. Bobby felt the need to honor the second part of his Schaefer Music Festival shift, which involved standing guard at the stage to keep fans from bum-rushing the band. He worried that something was going to happen. As he hustled towards the stage at the head of the Harvard Stadium's U-shaped outline, he couldn't help but run through worst-case scenarios in his head. What if Janis and the Full Tilt Boogie Band didn't show for hours? What if they didn't show at all? What if they had another Altamont on their hands? He didn't spot any Hell's Angels making their way through the turnstiles near the front of the venue, but bikers weren't the only ones turning violent anymore. What if the audience rioted in the way they rioted at Grant Park in Chicago when Sly and the Family Stone were a no-show? Or when Jim Morrison of the Doors led his audience to riot at the Singer Bowl in Queens? Janis ran with some shady people, that was for sure. Just look at the recent show she'd attempted to play for the Hell's Angels in San Rafael. The one that ended with Janis on the floor and half the local MC out for her blood. Even Canadian crowds had just stormed the gate at the Festival Express stop in Toronto. They caused such a commotion that organizers had to negotiate with the crowd. And that kind of shit didn't happen in Canada. Could it happen in Cambridge, Massachusetts? It can't happen here. That's what Bobby kept repeating to himself, silently, over and over in his head. It can't happen here. Bobby looked out at the crowd of thousands from where he stood at the edge of the stage. His happy-go-lucky outlook took a dive. His throat sank down to a pit somewhere at the bottom of his stomach. He pondered an early toke from the contraband joint he'd been handed through the gate that night, just to take the edge off. And then, at around 10:30 that night, Janis walked on stage, a bottle of J&B scotch in her hand where the Southern Comfort usually was. It was impossible to tell where her long strands of hair ended and the long stringy feathers she wore began. Moments later, the guys in the Full Tilt Boogie Band followed, and they plugged in, counted off, and roared to life. Bobby gradually settled down as all was forgiven by the audience, and Cambridge defaulted to having a good time. The best time, and the last time, too. That night would be the last time Janis Joplin would ever play Cambridge. The last time Janis Joplin would ever play anywhere. 2 months later, people would be waiting for Janis to show up again, like they often did. Only this time, she'd never show. Paul Rothschild was in love with Janis Joplin. Her laugh, her smile, her easy-breezy fuck-it-all attitude towards life. How she took zero shits from no one. The way she dressed with all those countless feathers and beads and bangles hanging and flowing and flowering in every direction. He had known that he was in love with her for quite some time. All the way back to when she fronted Big Brother and he tried to woo her away with a solo deal on Elektra. Now, in the middle of 1970, after making a name as the unofficial fifth member of The Doors, he had signed on to produce Janis' second solo album, and her first with the full Tilt Boogie Band as her backup. Even though Rothschild was in love with Janis, he was also a professional first and a love-struck puppy second. "Look, Janis," he told her one day, "I really love you, very, very much, and I'd like to be with you, but let's fuck on tape." He was worried just about as much as he was smitten. He had spent some time with Janis while she was making her last record, "I Got Them Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama," and he knew she was fighting some demons. He knew she was holding on to addictions. He saw the marks on her arms, the bags under her eyes. He knew where she went when she disappeared for a few minutes or a few hours at a time. It was moments like those that the colorful, expressive Janis he loved would find herself consumed by a dark cloud, and he would lose sight of her temporarily. He wouldn't recognize her. When Rothschild was first approached to produce Janis' new record in 1970, he initially refused because he was worried. He was ready to write her off as a once-talented junkie, a soon-to-be has-been, too consumed with bullshit to be worth his time. He loved her, and because he loved her, he couldn't bear to be a party to what was surely her downhill slide. Her voice was shot. All the touring, the smoking, the drinking, and the drugging had just ravaged the sound of her voice. She even asked Rothschild to accompany her to her shows and stand on the side of the stage with a stopwatch. "Tired, Paul," she said. "I'm tired and my voice hurts and my body aches. And I know that every night I only have 35 good minutes in me. 35 minutes flat. After that, I turn into a pumpkin." She placed the stopwatch in his hand and folded his fingers on top of it. "I want you to stand over there, on the other side of the curtain. And the minute the show starts, I want you to start the stopwatch," she told him. "When I turn around to look at you, I want you to flash me how many minutes I've got left." Rothschild was kept up at night, wondering what would happen if Janis went over 35 minutes. Janis convinced Rothschild to sit in the producer's chair for her latest sessions. And Janis appealed to the part of Rothschild that was in love with her. She told him not to worry. She told him she was turning things around, that she was pulling herself together, that she needed the support of people like him to help her over the next hill, to walk that next mile. Rothschild couldn't resist. Just being around her was intoxicating. It was everything he wanted a recording session to be. They would get the chance to fuck on tape, after all. But as good as the sessions were, Rothschild couldn't help but remain worried. He knew there was another shoe out there, somewhere, ready to drop. He'd seen it before with friends who were lost or addicted, friends who had sworn up and down that they had gotten clean, that there was nothing to worry about. Because there was always something to worry about. Rothschild had to do more than just produce. He had to step in, to intervene. He had to give a shit. But that just led to a new thing to worry about, and that despite his help and his love and his steady, well-meaning direction, that it would all be too late. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. All right, this episode of the 27 Club is brought to you by Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. to hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Nirvana, Prince, Jerry Lee Lewis, The Grateful Dead, The Rolling Stones, Cardi B, and many, many more. Go to amazon.com/Disgraceland. Or if you have an Echo device, just say, "Hey Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast." The 27 Club is hosted and co-written by me, Jake Brennan. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer and co-producer. Matt Bowden mixes the show. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Linetta. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. Our previous seasons on Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison are available for you to binge right now wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please be sure to find and follow the 27 Club on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your shows. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media, and we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. Give that a follow. So get out there and spread the word about the 27 Club. You can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock and roll.
What's up for your ears?